Hello, I'm May.
And I'm Jake.
And I'm Benita.
We're a group of young people, and Luke and May, based at the University of Hertfordshire, UK, called Hearts YPANG. YPANG stands for Young People's Advisory Group. We work with researchers to help them plan and do research about children and young people's health care, family lives, and the communities we live in.
Welcome to our podcast about children and young people's involvement in health and care research. In this series of three podcasts, we're talking to young people involved in research and the adults who work with them about why children and young people's involvement in research matters, how to do it well, and how it could develop in the future.
So, if you're a child or young person involved in or interested in being involved in research, or a parent or carer or researcher or other adult who is working in or interested in children and young people's involvement, listen up and then join in the conversation. Today we're talking to researchers and others working to involve children and young people in research about opportunities and future directions.
Okay, now we'll go around and do introductions. Can you please tell us your name, your job and where you work, and a fun fact about yourself. For example, something that you've done, a hobby, an unusual pet, etc. I'll start. You already know my name and that I'm a member of the Hearts YPANG. A fun fact about me is that I won a school talent show by doing comedy with my best friend Zia.
He may yet do a joke. We'll see how we go.
Okay, so Jacob, do you want to pick who should start?
Jenny.
Oh, thanks. Okay, so my name's Jenny Preston. I'm Senior Patient and Public Involvement Manager at the University of Liverpool. I am the facilitator and co-founder of the Liverpool Young Persons Advisory Group, and I coordinate the Generation R Alliance. A fun fact about me, although it might not be funny, I used to be a leader in a dance troupe called the Speak Rockettes, and I was in that for many, many years. And then my mum, although I think she'd done it deliberately, threw all of my medals that I won into the bin, and I was so disappointed. I worked so hard all those years to in that troop to win those medals. So, but I don't know whether that's funny, but that's a fact about me.
Hello to everybody. It's my pleasure to be today with all of you. I'm Begoña Nafria. I'm working at Sant Joan de Déu Children's Hospital in Barcelona, in Spain. My role in the hospital is to coordinate a department that is devoted to incorporate the voice of children and young people like you and parents in research and in innovation projects. I coordinate the Kids Barcelona YPAC that you explained before what stands for. And also with Jenny Preston and two other colleagues from Scotland and France, we set up in 2017 a YPACnet, that is the European Young Persons Advisory Group Network. And a fun fact of me, it's not easy to choose. I like a lot jokes, but this is not a fun fact. Something that I want to mention that it's one of my favorite hobbies is to travel. I like a lot to travel, to learn, to meet people, and to make the feel that the world is small. Because in fact, like today, we can be connected from many different places that are far in a very easy way.
That's great. Thank you. And Begoña and Jen, we will maybe come a bit later on. You can tell us a bit more about Generation R Alliance and EYPAGnet as well.
Matthew?
Hiya. So my name's Matthew Walsham. I work at Partnership for Young London. We're a regional youth unit for London, and I lead on policy and campaigns. So funded by Trust for London over the past 3, 4, 5 years, time flies, we've supported about 15 organisations to do peer research projects in a range of subjects, from mental health to physical health to identity, gentrification, basically whatever young people are interested in researching. In terms of fun fact, before I thought research was cool, I wanted to become a cook. So I went and worked in a kitchen in south of France. And I thought, great, I'm going to learn loads of stuff. And after 6 months, all I'd made is about 500 tarte au citrons, which is basically a fancy lemon tart. So if you want me to make a tarte au citron, very good at it. Anything else, not so great.
Hi, my name's Kath Larkins. Really pleased to be here. I'm director of a centre for children and young people's participation at a university in the north of England called the University of Central Lancashire. And I'm one of a group of directors who work really closely with a group of young people called UCAN. Well, that's the name they've chosen for themselves. And they're young researchers, well, you know, young people who start research projects, advise other young people on research projects, do peer research, you know, do all sorts of things. And they've got a bit of a big network that's growing with other people to do that kind of work. Fun fact about me, I love music. Used to be a DJ, still play guitar a lot. I've been in bands, and I try to bring music into pretty much everything I do if I possibly can.
Hi, thank you, Jacob. So I'm Lucy Bray. I'm a children's nurse originally. Now I work as a professor of child health literacy at Edgehill University, which is near Ormskirk in the northwest of England. Child health literacy, because no one ever knows what it means, is really focused on how we can design information for children and young people that makes sense to them, that meets their needs, that they can get involved in choices and decisions and kind of shape their own healthcare. So that's kind of all the research that I do. A bit of pressure now to think of something fun as a fact. Thinking about pets, you'd suggested we could talk about pets. So we have two dogs, a cat and two chickens who all live pretty happily together, enjoying our nice sunny weather. So yeah, really pleased to be here. Thank you for asking me to be part of this.
So we're going to start with some questions about what being involved in research is like for young people and how it makes a difference. So Benita, do you want to ask the first question?
Okay. What do you do to involve children and young people in research?
You've talked about this, I think, a little bit in your introduction, but is there anything else you want to say about what you do to involve young children and young people?
So a bit of an annoying kind of politician answer would be it depends. So it depends on the project. It depends on what we're trying to do. It depends on what children and young people think we should be doing and how we should be doing it. And so I think that the reason why I love working with children and young people is because it's never the same. Each project is always really, really different. We get to try different things. We get to speak to different people. We get to ask different questions. So for me, being a researcher working with children and young people, you never quite know where things are going to lead because it's all really, really different. So how you involve them depends on the project and what you want to kind of find out.
One of the big things I do is try to get money so that the money can go to children, so that children can decide how they want to use it to investigate the subjects that really matter to them. So I do that by applying for funds and supporting other colleagues who also apply for funds. And sometimes we're really lucky. And at the moment, we've got quite a few projects where young people from the very start have helped design a research project, or they've just got some money and now they're thinking about how they want to spend it and what they want to investigate.
Lucy?
Yeah, Jacob, thank you. So I think children and young people make a massive difference across all of research. So for the work that I would do with young people, they would kind of shape what we're asking in the first place to make sure that as adults we're asking the right questions, that we're not asking questions that interest us that have no relevance to children and young people. So we would learn from children and young people what matters in your life. What does this look like for you in your life? What questions should we be asking in the first place? And that needs to be really, really early on. And I think needs to be with adults that there's a bit of a relationship with. So quite often, this might answer one of your later questions, Jacob. Sorry if it does. But quite often we'll be asked to, can we just ask these children and young people this? Well, they don't know who we are. They don't know that we're half decent people. They don't know that we are going to listen to their opinions and do something with it. So I think it's working with children and young people right from the beginning, not going with what we think is right and then changing it slightly, but just going straight from the beginning and saying, what should we be doing? What matters to you? What does this even look like for these children and young people? So that's kind of right from the outset. And then throughout kind of the whole journey, so that the way that we're asking children and young people makes sense, it works with their lives, it's in ways that they feel comfortable to share, they feel able to share, that we don't exclude children and young people because it's easier for us to use a certain method, and that automatically cuts out tons of children and young people from being able to take part, to the end, right? You're kind of right at the end. So what do we do with all this stuff that we've collected? How do we work out what it means, and how do we tell other people about it so that it can make a change?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I was going to ask you about that, Matt, actually, about kind of, you know, from your perspective in terms of doing peer research, you know, when young people are doing research on things that matter to them, how do you get that to make a difference to communities, to services, to the things that they want to change?
Well, when we ask kind of policymakers why, and funders why they're particularly interested in funding peer research, the word that always comes up again is authentic. You know, it's authentically coming from young people. And it's kind of difficult to know really what that means on the ground. For us, what it means is the group of young people researching that issue is, it's an issue that affects their lives. It is their local community. They have lived experience of that. And I think getting young people involved in research when it's specific from that community, the involvement that they make, when we're talking about the difference, yes, there's the stuff around question formulation, the questions will be better. But actually, when I go back and argue to policymakers why they need to pay attention to this piece of research, it's not just because young people have done it and they have a duty to listen to young people, which they do, but it's actually the research itself is of a better quality. I'm always arguing for the research quality being better with young people, not only just designing it, but also being in the fieldwork stage. So doing those in-depth interviews. We're doing a project at the moment with the House Project, which is Care Experience Young People. And it's cohorts of young people who've been through 2-3 years of the House Project interviewing people at the beginning of their journey. And the way that they can have conversations, very frank conversations about what works, what doesn't, is far more honest than I could ever do coming in from an outsider. So research quality is better, question formulation is better. And I think a lot of organizations in local and regional government are starting to wake up to peer research or participatory research as not a replacement to, but as a form of youth voice, which, you know, is really important in policy making, you know, that is sitting alongside stuff like youth councils, youth advisory boards and all the rest of it.
I think that's a really interesting point, actually, about it almost being an end in itself in terms of being about, you know, another way for young people to have a say about things that affect them. And that also links to the idea, because I think we quite often talk about the benefits for research and the benefits for young people of being involved in terms of skills and experience. But there's another kind of fundamental argument for all this, which is children's rights and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and children and young people, particularly Article 12, about children and young people's right to have a say in matters that affect them. And that's really, really key as well. I mean, Kath, what are your thoughts on that, and about, you know, how can young people's involvement in research make a difference?
It makes a difference, I think, when it changes and challenges the power balance. Mm. I think that overall, children tend to be in a position where they have less power than adults. And because of that, they have a particular experience of the world. And when you're looking at an experience of the world, I tend to want to know what the experience of is of those people who don't have the power. And by enabling them to ask the questions and to take the action with it, they're creating resources which help them be more powerful and can really sort of emotionally and robustly, statistically, and any range of evidence criteria, what they create speaks to people because it's general, because it's from a different place it's from experience. So anything we can do to increase the way that children frame research as in how it's designed, how it's done, how it's shared, increases the way that it speaks to other people about the things that matter.
And that kind of links to what Matthew was saying about, you know, kind of voice and like participation, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's right. Yeah. It's right because it's better knowledge. It's right because it's their right to do that. It's right because it changes power. And it's right because it opens up those moments where change is possible in the world.
And Benita, you had something you wanted to say.
I was going to say, yeah, it gives us a voice and we're allowed to project that voice. And it gives us the opportunity where someone actually listens to us and, like, takes it in and, like, puts work into it. And then we may feel like we may have different perspectives to you but it makes a difference because it is our future and it gives us experience. Because I'm in the YPAG, I know that when I walk into my workplace, I'm going to walk confidently, I'm going to use my voice, and I'm going to make a difference. And it helps us decide the future for our children, and it just prepares us for the real world in general.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And yeah, absolutely. And that's another really important point about how it's not just about what difference it makes to young people when they're being involved, but it's actually what skills, what experience they get and what they take from that experience of involvement to then go into whatever else they're going to do as adults.
And I think it makes a difference for you and it makes a difference for the other young people whose voices you're representing through your research. And therefore, it's a more inclusive model of participation because you're speaking for other people and you're helping people who don't get heard, maybe don't have the confidence to walk into your group. You're helping them be heard by the people who really need to listen to them.
Absolutely. Thank you. What about you, Jenny? Is there anything else you wanted to say about how young people's involvement makes a difference?
I think, without repeating what other people have said, really, I mean, it was a long time ago that I was a child, and likewise, most researchers as well. So we don't know what it's like to be a child in this current day and age. So they will know what services in my field, so what services, what treatments, what care they would like to receive, how they would like to receive that, you know, the practicalities of clinical trials, for example. They know that and they can inform us on all of those issues quite easily. So we have seen, you know, a huge impact in how they have made a difference to clinical trials. And ultimately, like what you said, Luca May, in terms of how it can impact, and what Kath said, impact on how other young people receive those services, if they are designed and if they are being listened to within the YPAGs, for example. And if researchers really take on board what they have said, that informs their research, then ultimately, or hopefully, you'd like to see an impact in long-term services for children. So yeah, that's my point of view, really.
And the impact thing is really important as well. And I think that's the other follow-up question I was going to ask about that, about how do we know, how can we demonstrate? Because obviously, you know, what we're talking about is kind of like, you know, we're all kind of fully converted to why this is a good idea, but what do we need to do? How do we sort of prove to people that this is worth doing? Because we'll come on to this in a minute, but I think, you know, Kath already alluded to the fact, you know, the fact that this needs time, this needs money. How do we convince people that this is something that's worth investing in? And part of that is about how do we show what difference it makes, you know, evaluating involvement. And I think one of the things that we haven't historically as a field been very good at is showing people how it makes a difference. So I don't know if anyone has any thoughts about that, about how we, you know, we all know it does make a difference, but how do we demonstrate that? Yes, Matthew.
Yeah, straight away thinking about it, because we were talking about it yesterday. So we're trying to develop up an evaluation framework for peer research at the moment. And, you know, when we support organizations to do this work, they're all using different things. Things you can guarantee are usually evaluated are the outcomes for young people. Soft skills, speaking, listening, research skills. Young Foundation recently have developed a really good accredited program for young people to become level 2, level 3 peer researchers. But actually, kind of part of the thing that's missing are the other two components. So you've got the skills for young people, outcomes for them, great. But the first thing is measuring participation. Like, how do we measure kind of the core things for me about peer research? Young person's sense of agency, ownership over a program, and also their interdependence. And the interdependence part of it is, how are they engaging with external stakeholders, policymakers, decision makers, and how early are they doing that to make sure that the program is relevant and also is feeding into existing policy contexts? The last thing you want is for them to do this really purely youth-led project, and 6 months down the line, they have a bunch of recommendations that are broad, not specific, and because you haven't involved the people who make the decisions at the beginning, it kind of falls on deaf ears. And then the third thing is that impact side of it. So there's the impact for the organization. You know, how are you embedding this participation work in the work that you do as an organization? How are you redesigning the services that you have in-house? But then actually, how do we measure the long-term impact? You know, in terms of decisions made, strategies, influences, how many times it's referenced. And I think really the big tricky thing is with this is funding. generally peer research projects are funded to deliver the project. And by delivering the project, it isn't delivering the change, it's delivering the output that is the research report, the presentation, getting young people to talk about it, which is great. But actually, funders need to recognize that we need longitudinal support for 6 months, 3 months, to actually research phase is over. You are now young campaigners. You are now young activists. How do we change you into going out there and actually arguing for that change based on the results? You know, the research will still be relevant for 6 months, a year, maybe even 2 years, depending on the sample. So actually, there's a huge window for them to campaign on change, but usually it just kind of all drops as soon as the report is out.
So it's a really, really important point, I think, that thinking about what happens beyond the report. And I think, you know, in the case of that sort of, you know, the YPERS, the Young People's Advisory Groups, you know, what happens beyond a researcher coming along and having a session with the young people. And I know, Jamie, we mentioned the Generation R Alliance briefly earlier, and you can say a little bit more about what that is. But I think also we had in a recent meeting of the Alliance, we were talking about this, weren't we, about the need to do more to evaluate and try, again, it always comes back to funding, doesn't it? But trying to get some funding to do a bigger comparative evaluation of young people's involvement in research and the difference it makes in the longer term and to young people as well as to research. So I don't know if maybe Jen and then Begonia, we could talk about that in terms of the Generation R Alliance and maybe EYPAGnet as well.
So Jen. Yeah, so the Generation R Alliance is a network of YPAGs across the UK. They tend to be based in NHS or university organisations, all with the remit to involve children, young people in the design of health research. Our group, like I said, is predominantly about medicines research and technology. But we work with qualitative researchers as well, like Lucy and her colleague. So we work together because we realized it's brilliant for the community to share good practice, to share our challenges, to share lessons learned, but also to share opportunities with wider groups of young people across the UK. And Begonia will explain the European network that we formed several years ago, which is a similar network but across Europe. And we've been trying to do the same thing there. But I think, as you mentioned, Luke and May, you know, the issues that we've got within our field is the biggest problem that we've got is lack of standardized evaluation for measuring what Matthew was calling, you know, short, long-term impacts. But the biggest problem that we face is lack of feedback from researchers about even just the short-term impacts of what they've done as a result of what young people said. And what they've changed or not changed, and you can justify why they haven't changed that. We don't even get that for most of the cases. So recently we've tried to tackle that head on by getting our young people to develop an award system so that each researcher who comes to our group will be awarded or scored on the basis of a set criteria that they've designed, and that will include whether they fed back in a timely manner, whether that's just simply, we've took your thoughts, we've changed it slightly, we've took it to ethics, but we're still waiting on a response. Simple as that, you know, so that we get that. Some researchers are fantastic at that and some less so. So we need to get better at chasing our researchers to say, okay, so what's happened as a result? Because it really does put off our young people for taking part because they don't feel as if they're making any difference because they're not hearing back from researchers. So we always talk about these things in the Alliance meetings because it is a common issue that we all face.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to the power thing that Kath was talking about, I think, about, you know, the researchers come in, you know, in the kind of groups that we're talking about, researchers come in, get input from young people and then tick the box to say they've done their involvement and off they go. And actually it's that kind of making that this is a reciprocal arrangement and this is about, you know, yeah, there is an expectation, but it's really hard to enforce that. I mean, Begonia, what would you say from the kind of perspective of EYPAGnet in terms of how can we show that, you know, young people's groups who are involved in the network make a difference, and how can we compare across groups as well?
Yeah, the main aim when we decided to set up EYPAGnet, that it's built on top of the model of Generation R, is to connect groups of young people that have been trained and educated in clinical research and in clinical trials across Europe, because we think that as clinical trials are performed in different European countries, PPI or patient and public involvement deserves to follow the same model. First of all, in terms of diversity, because we have seen in different projects that according no, with your cultural background, the country where you are based, the standard of care that no that it's performed in your country, probably no, the feedback and the contribution to research, it's different. And diversity at the end it's an asset, because no, if in the future these medicines or these devices are in the market, will be open to a big population instead of the small number of patients that are involved in a clinical trial. As Jenny said, we have challenges, and the success to work in a network is to try to standardize everything, because no, we can do an activity in Spain, another one in the UK or France, whatever, but the activity, the method, and everything needs to be standardized and work in parallel. This is something important. Another thing is provide for researchers or any other stakeholder interested to approach to the community of patients a single point of contact. It's easy, the process, because design the methodology, perform the activity, collect the feedback, etc. It's a long time. And if we can centralize and work all together, it's more easy for everybody. And about the feedback and the impact of our activities, still I think that it's a pending subject, because from our side, obviously, we design the activity with the best method. We are working with qualitative and other methodologies that make PPI also, for me, like a research project. You have a question, you think, no, which is the best way to collect the answers to these questions, and you analyze the info. But still, there is a no common practice about the implementation of the suggestions, ideas, or needs of the patients. And it's a long fight. Sometimes we never get this information. In another cases, it came late, but it came. And I think that beyond what we do with the patients and our projects, still we need to educate the community of researchers and in general all the stakeholders about the importance to incorporate the voice of the patient in first perspective, but to finalize the whole process, getting back to us about what we have achieved together, because it's facts and information that we need to demonstrate the evidence about the work that we do. Of course, common sense said to us that if you involve the patients, the project will be better for them. But at the end, we need the evidence, examples, and still continue learning, because every project, as Lucy said, it's different. And I think the added value that we have working together with Jenny and many other colleagues is the expertise that we have from our different experience.
I think that's really important. And it goes back to this idea, I think, Mia, what you're talking about, Matthew, about kind of having time at the end to kind of all the kind of implementation and impact stuff that researchers get drummed into them all the time is really important, but also time to stop and reflect about what did we learn about doing this project together, not just kind of getting all this piece of work. I think there's just building in time to actually reflect and evaluate and look back on that. Yes, Lucy.
And then we'll move on to your question. I was just thinking, listening to the other kind of guys talk, thinking about how we can look at what difference it makes. Matthew talked about a framework and a way to do that kind of standardized across all of the practices that we have. But also when we get to the end of a research project and we write those papers, we know the way that we talk about how young people were involved in research projects can be pretty poor sometimes. I think there's still a tendency to talk about the nice bits, the bits that worked well, the bits that sound like we did an amazing job, and maybe less so about, this really didn't work. We really struggled to do this. And from that, we have learned. I think sometimes we're not always as transparent as researchers as we should be to talk about things that haven't gone well or that we didn't do as well as we would have liked. We tend to report more, we did this amazing work with young people. And I think we conducted a recent review that shows that how researchers are reporting involving children and young people is really a bit poor. It's kind of like we involved 5 young people who helped shape the study. That doesn't tell me anything, So I think we as researchers and academics, we need to be much, much better at honestly reporting actually what we did and actually the difference that that made on what we ended up doing. I think there's a change.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what I find as well is, you know, you read so many, you know, academic journal articles and other things about young people's involvement in research, and so many of them are just written by the researchers as well. And I push back on that a lot as well. Just like, well, what did the, you know, you get lots of, you know, you get so many, you know, journal articles and book chapters by researchers about, oh, we involved some researchers and it was, you know, young researchers or young people and everyone had a really lovely time and it was all great. And I was like, but where are the young people's voices? And that's quite often because the young people have, like, you know, you said, yeah, the funding's ended, they've moved on, the project's finished. But it's still, I think that there's a real gap there. But yes, Kath, and then we'll go on to the next question.
I just wanted to say, the young people who I work with have created a memory bank where we can record impact, the impact that comes from our research. And I think that idea is lovely. And to do that, develop ways of categorizing the kind of, like, a checklist of, did you make no difference at all? Or did it help people understand more? Or has it changed what's happening in your community? Or, you know, and so giving that, sharing that with people and encouraging them to hold their research in this shared space and then go back and add when there's been extra impact can really help, because sometimes making a difference takes time.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I'll leave it there.
No, but lovely to. I mean, I think within one of the things we could maybe do in adjacent to this podcast is have, if there are any resources or links or information that people want to share, we'll post all this. We'll put the podcast with a blog post so we can. So if there's anything you've got about that, Kath, it'll be really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And just to say, the young people involved in that are co-editing a special edition of Childhood Journal where everything will be written by young people and by the academics working with them. And
that's amazing.
A young person summary of everything, and that will go on the website, and the academic article will go in the journal. But there's something about drawing everything together so it's all in one place that I think is great too.
Yeah, well, that sounds fantastic. Thank you. Yeah, and it'd be lovely to know a bit more about both of those. Okay, Benita.
Did the COVID-19 pandemic change anything?
Obviously it changed lots of things for all of us, but I suppose how do you think it changed things in terms of the work that you do, that we all do around evolving young people in research?
Anyone? Jenny?
Thanks, Jay. So we had great plans because, as I mentioned, we were predominantly with YPAG, the YPAG model. And we have set up focus groups for disease specific groups and researchers in the past, but it does tend to be the YPAG model. So we were really conscious that we need to build into our strategy an outreach program that we wanted to raise awareness to groups of young people who wouldn't necessarily know that we exist, or an education program, or going into youth centres to talk about what we do to youth groups. And that stopped us in our tracks completely. So we couldn't do that until it got back to normal. But I can gladly say that we've started a science club. We call it a science club, that the young people have named themselves in a locally deprived area of Liverpool. And we've been running now for every month. And it's been absolutely fantastic. We don't really mention the word research. We don't really mention anything about what we do yet. We're letting the young people guide us in the processes. So they tell us what they would like to learn more of. So we had one last night and the numbers are growing. So from the ages of about 4 up to 14, we just let them come in. They put on little white coats. Some are really oversized because we didn't expect the young 4-year-olds to come in and take part. But they're really informing us and telling us more than ever about what health issues are affecting them in their lives. Now, bear in mind, this is a youth centre that they go to predominantly eat, get their food, hot meals. You know, in the winter, they go there to play with other young people, to stay off the streets and so on. So it's us that are out of our comfort zone by going to the young people as opposed to expecting young people to come to us. So COVID did stop us in our tracks in terms of our outreach work, but it didn't in terms of the YPAG, because the majority of the YPAG members could join us online in Zoom meetings. They were quite comfortable with that. But we have to be mindful of those who are from low-income families who might be digitally excluded. So they're the things that we have to think about, you know, in terms of how accessible are YPAG meetings, for example, and how accessible is it for the young people who are from low-income families, from, you know, from different backgrounds and so on. So it did impact on us quite a bit, really.
Yeah, I think I definitely would agree with that. I think it's, I think the biggest thing for me was, like, you know, the really steep learning curve. But actually, you know, gave a talk, you know, Matthew was saying earlier, I think in some ways it was a real leveler, because we suddenly, you know, because I was working with the IYPAG at Moorfields when the pandemic hit, we'd only ever met in person, and suddenly we had to switch to online, and I had no clue how to do Zoom meetings, and the young people kind of got it a lot quicker than I did. And actually, I think that the other thing you talk about in terms of access is actually what we found with that group is, because we had a lot of young disabled people in that group, actually for some of them, Zoom meetings are a lot more accessible than in person. And, you know, so I think it's been quite interesting. I think both the kind of the learning, I think there's, for some young people, actually Zoom is better, and for some it's not. And what we found in the group that we're in is we're trying to kind of work towards co-productions. It's not a co-produced group yet, but we're kind of aiming in that direction. So we're trying to kind of work with young people to decide how the group works. And so we decided that we alternate meeting online and in person, because online kind of works quite well as an after-school thing. It's quite convenient. But on in person is a lot more fun, and they get to do a lot more stuff together. And one of the challenges, I think, is just having to, you know, trying to find ways for young people to interact with each other when you're online, rather than it being a kind of adult-child thing. But I think COVID was like, it created a lot of opportunities and new ways of working, as well as, obviously, you know, some quite serious challenges. But I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts on that, about what we've learned. Yes, Begonia, and then Kath.
Yeah, from our side, as you can imagine, we had to deal from one day to another to move our regular meetings to virtual meetings. We survived at the end. No, we could manage to do even some projects that at the beginning it seemed for us challenging in a virtual format. We incorporate new young people during this period, and it was amazing the first time that they could meet in person, because this human touch that you can be, you know, when you are closer in a meeting room, you cannot manage virtually. And they miss a lot this piece. And the good thing for me is that we could be involved into hackathons during this period, international ones, and the only way to deal with this was virtually. We took advantage that we were in lockdown and basically performing all our meetings virtually, and we did once the first year of the pandemic with the Boston Children's Hospital, and the second one it was last year with the Gosh Hospital in London in the UK, and the SeedKids in Toronto, and was amazing. We took advantage of what we learned after these many months of the pandemic, and perform a new activity that we never did with our group. But I agree with Jenny, and I suppose with the other colleagues that are today in this podcast, that face-to-face, it's really, really worthy to work, not only with the project per se. I think that it's so important what we are doing with these young people in terms of skills, human values, because in our case, we have few members that are healthy ones, and it's amazing what they can see, because sometimes you don't realize that there are kids with your age with, you know, a very complicated condition that sometimes, no, they just finalized the treatment in the hospital and they came to the meeting with the YPAGs. And I think that also this is a lesson learned that I think that they will have, no, forever in their lives, these human values.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that's a very good point as well, that actually it wasn't just about how it affected participation. It was the fact that we all and all the young people we work with had an awful lot of other stuff going on in their lives while it was all going on. So yes, Kath.
I think as you just said, it gave some opportunities for young people to get together nationally and internationally in ways that they hadn't always had. We in that space, we developed new methodologies like hackathons, which were really inclusive, maybe of people who wouldn't have had a chance to be involved. but it was also a really good way of getting people in fairly sort of powerful and influential positions to come and meet with young people. So as everybody started to meet online much more than they were previously, people have become more comfortable with that. And now I run events where young people interview really senior European civil servants online and ask them difficult questions in a way that would have taken months and months to organise if it was happening physically, if they'd even agreed to it. So it's levelled some things out, which I think is really useful, as well as meaning that we miss each other a bit more. The young people that I work with, miss each other, and I miss them.
No, I think that's true. I think it also creates opportunities like this, where we can kind of, we're all based in different parts of the UK and in Spain, and we can, and I think that's, having these opportunities is good, but it's just, what you miss as well.
What are the biggest challenges to involving children and young people in research?
I mean, we've kind of touched on some already in terms of, the resourcing and the time that's involved. What would you say for you, Lucy? What's the biggest challenge for you, do you think?
Oh, no, it wasn't me personally, I guess. I was just going to avoid the resources and not enough money kind of question. But I think there continues to be people that don't work with children and young people continue to underestimate how amazing children and young people are. I think they worry about adults working with children and young people, and I think they underestimate how amazing they are and actually what they can bring to projects. I think is still something that needs to be overcome.
What about anybody else? Well, what would you say, I think, Matthew, what would you say for you are the biggest challenges to doing peer research with young people?
I think it's underestimated how difficult it is necessarily to teach research all the time, especially given the time frames. I mean, people go to university and do 3 years, they do masters in it, and then when you have sort of 6 weeks to kind of teach it, it's not so much that it may not be enough time, but sometimes it's about how do you adjust to make it relevant for the community that you're speaking to. You cannot use the word interview, you can use conversations, but there is a serious point where you have to talk about research ethics, when you have to talk about consent, you have to talk about GDPR, and that can be quite challenging sometimes. There's a real tension in terms of the recruitment where, some of the best young people, most situated in that community, who understand kind of the needs of it, are probably less likely interested in research always, And you'll get people who are really interested in research, want to do it at university, but then they might be a step removed from the issue they're facing. So there can be a temptation to do the path of least resistance, where you recruit 5 young people who are sort of on it, will turn up to every meeting, have cameras on in Zooms, will do the work really, really well, but then it kind of loses that authenticity. So how do you kind of manage those two groups? I also think the other part of it is the soft skills side. So we believe that young people can do anything. We try and empower them best we can. But there is a conversation that needs to be had about the soft skills existing in those that you recruit, especially if you want to do qualitative research. I sometimes think it's underestimated how hard it is to do interviews and focus groups by commissioners and funders. We can support young people to do it, but ultimately it's a real skill that takes time to learn how to do and be comfortable to do it. So again, path of least resistance. You recruit maybe a bunch of young people who have those social skills, really comfortable speaking, really, really confident. But then are they getting as much from the process, and are they as authentic as others in that process as well? So that constantly divide.
That's a very interesting point. And that goes, it's also what we were talking about earlier about, time for dissemination and reflection at the end. But there's that thing about actually, again, it does kind of link into resourcing, this idea that actually to do peer research well takes time and it takes knowledge. And we'll come on in a minute to the question about how to involve diverse, marginalised, less often heard young people in research as well, because I think that's something that, you've touched on there, which I think is really important.
I was going to say the biggest challenges to involving children and young people in research, maybe sometimes like when you're actually trying to tell them like something important, sometimes like they might have had a bond or like they probably won't, but sometimes maybe they might be messing around or like maybe sometimes they'll be chatting when you want them to be focusing on and listening, and then you sort of have to tell them to be quiet, but you don't want to tell them to be quiet because
Yeah, and that's a good point because like, I think
you want them to make friendships, but you want them to listen in as well.
And that's important when people are at school or at college all day and they're tired and it's the evening. Or, you know, when we do evening meetings, you've been at school or college all day and then it's like, then you have to concentrate on something else. I think that can be difficult. Yes.
I think it might be a challenge for you to involve us in research because we're uneducated about what research is in school. But the thing is that I love going beyond like an extra mile to do work for school. So I'd like do presentations and stuff. So I was like interested in research. And when I heard about it, I was like, I want to go there. But I've realised that most people in my social group and like my age are not really keen on trying something new or stepping out of the comfort zone. And personally, I wasn't comfortable with doing that. But like my mum pushed me to do it and it was a good thing because I've made lots of new friends and I've learned lots of new skills. And I think that you need to add interactive activities into your research. Like Jacob was saying, like young children may get distracted easily. So if we have interactive activities, then it would be easier to concentrate. And you might have to split ages into different groups whilst you're having like your WIPAG meeting because some ages may be interested in like certain activities than other ages. And like if you were using drawings to help with the research, the older people may not be interested with that part. So that's what I have to say.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Yes.
Adding on to Benita's point, and a little bit on mine, I think maybe like you should have like some sort of thing that shows them to sort of, so like maybe a clap or like this.
Yeah.
Or like maybe you could say like stop, or maybe you could like, maybe it's like just find like something that they know.
Or we can find ways to make it fun and interesting so they don't get bored. But yes, I think definitely, I mean, I think it's a really important point that young people often have a lot of other things going on in their lives. And it's quite hard. And I think also it's that thing about, you know, like belief system, which is really important about young people we're kind of moving on to the next bit about what might make it difficult for some children, young people to get involved in research. And I think one of the challenges is that quite often people don't know what research is. And I don't know, Jenny, do you want to say something a little bit about the work that you've been doing with the Health Research Authority about teaching on ethics in schools? Because that might be relevant to that.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is that the world of patient and public involvement tends to be driven from an adult perspective. The young people, for example, are a bit of an afterthought, which is unfortunate, despite all the work that's been going on the last 20 odd years and in different fields, not just medicine. So that's one of the biggest challenges, is making sure that what we develop is appropriate for children and young people in this field. One of the things that came out recently was the Health Research Authority's strategy on making research that people can trust. And they consulted with the adult population, but they hadn't consulted with young people specifically. So I take part in a lot of, or I deliver training with the HRA for paediatric researchers and ethics committees. And one of the lay members on one of the ethics committees used to be in the Department for Work and Pension. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was the Department of Education in the curriculum development team. And he had approached the HRA and said, well, why aren't you going into schools and teaching young people about the ethics of research and teaching how, you know, what research is for young people? And Begonia and I were involved in a European project to develop education resources for children and young people, to teach them about clinical trials, to teach them about health technologies, and to teach them about their rights to be involved in those discussions. So we had resources that are available, and we contacted the HRA to say, can we develop these with the HRA stamp to say, and get these into schools in the UK? But that are co-produced by young people themselves. So we're working on that project now, which is one way to get into connect to children. But actually, for me, like the young people have said, it really is hard to get into groups of young people or connect with groups of young people that don't know what we do. They might not have an interest in research, but they don't know. They don't have an interest in research until we actually work with them to see if they have an interest in research, like the Science Club, for example. I'm really surprised at how many young people are so interested in science and they want to learn and they want to tell us what's wrong. I think the biggest problem they have is that young people, we're not good enough at selling the opportunities that we have to a wider group of young people. So they don't know involvement activities or opportunities exist in the first place. And I think we need to get better at that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really important point. And that kind of links into... Oh, yeah, sorry, Benita.
I just had one extra point to add. I feel like children feel... Not even just children. I feel like people think it's about being smart or being... Or like adults may feel like getting involved in research means you have to be educated. That's not really what it is about. It's just like... Everyone has their opinions and ideas. It allows you to like discover new things, and it's just a great opportunity.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I certainly have people who said, "Oh, yeah, no, but they couldn't be involved in research because they're not academic enough." And it's it's really I think kind of getting over that, and that kind of that links into the question that you were going to ask, wasn't it?
How do we involve different
children
and young people in research?
This is really about how do we involve diverse, different, the kind of children and young people who wouldn't normally get involved in research, and are there different ways to do that? So obviously we've talked a lot about young people's advisory groups, but it's kind of different approaches, more sort of inclusive approaches that work to involve less often heard young people.
Does anyone want to answer? Matthew?
Oh, Begonia had a hand up.
Yeah,
and then, yeah.
Begonia.
No problem at all if you want to answer, Matthew, first, no? Okay. No, I was interested to explain that everything doesn't start or ends with WIPACs, because in the WIPACs we have patients with different conditions and, as I said previously, also healthy young people. And if the project requires to have, some specific, experience living with a specific disease, what we need to do in this case is have the capability to reach this specific group of patients. Knowing also that even if we have this group of patients, diversity is always around gender, cultural background. There are many elements that affect diversity. And what we need to try to do is to include as much we can the diversity from the real world of the patients living with this disease to the ones that know they have been selected or they have been invited or they have approached us, it depends of the scenario, to be part of advisory group in a specific project. And connecting also this point with previous discussion, I think that it's our social responsibility also to approach the society to science and research. No, the project that Jenny mentioned about the science club, the stuff that we did also with Jenny with the YEA project. In Spain, for example, in a school, in the curriculum, there is nothing about how we do research in medicines or in technology. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't have a disease, probably you can volunteer, because also we need healthy volunteers for vaccines trials. And I think that it's important that the society, they know about that we need more research for children, because we don't have treatment for many, many conditions. And I think that it's a mix, no? To balance, depending of the project, if it's a WIPAC, the ones that they can contribute, or if we need a group of patients with a specific disease from more than one country, if we want to involve the parents. I think that, and again, no, I repeat the words of my colleague Lucy, every project is different, and I think that it's an asset, no, the expertise and the learnings that we have get along these many years working with young people and parents, of course.
Yes, thank you. No, I think that's a really good point, and I think it's, we talked about this a bit, I think, in the podcast we did with facilitators about the kind of, because obviously in that group we had some people who run what we call, so I suppose, generic young people. So young people who are there because they have an interest in research or because they live in a particular area, And then in that case, there were quite a few people who were doing work with young people who were using mental health services. And then, you know, when you're using what with young people who have specific lived experience, that's different. But it's quite often, if you have this idea of, like, you know, whether young people want to commit to being a member of the Young People's Advisory Group or in a peer research project, and how can you involve young people who want a different approach or who aren't able to commit to something like that? Yes, Lucy.
So just quickly, really, I think it is really important, and YPAGs are amazing. Worked with them, lots of different YPAGs. The ideas are always, you know, really interesting, but they are often quite a select, can often be quite a select group of young people. And, you know, Benita, you were saying that this wasn't something that you thought that you really wanted to do. You didn't really see the point of it. And so I think that's probably what lots of young people think. So I think there is a responsibility for us as researchers to go to where young people are that don't really see the point, that would never have parents that would bring them to a YPAG, that wouldn't really see the point of coming to a YPAG. So it's kind of going to where young people are in community centres, in schools, often those people that wouldn't ever join something quite formal, and thinking a little bit more flexibly. So rather than that model of regular kind of meetings, because not everyone will commit or wants to commit in that way, how can we work flexibly based on this young person's quite happy to do this, but that's too much. This young person wants to communicate only via email. That's fine. So thinking flexibly, how do we work for each individual young person? Benita, I can see you've got a question.
Yeah, I think you need to let the young people know that every opinion is valued and it makes a difference.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think I think sometimes it is about, I've certainly worked on a lot of projects where you've gone to young people and worked in ways that work for them. And some people that might just be, they might just want to come to a one-off meeting and not commit to being involved in the project. So, but yes, Matthew, I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so when we're looking at recruiting young people from diverse backgrounds, or, you know, particularly young people who wouldn't be necessarily interested in research or don't typically get involved in policy work or campaigning or YPAGs, you know, it can be a real challenge. But I kind of think four ways I think were really important to us. Firstly, the recruitment stage, we try and make it as specific as possible. It's really difficult for young people who have lots going on in their lives, and they've got schoolwork and they're worrying about other things, to give up that time for a research project that involves the whole of London. You know, we work in London, it's a really young city. I can't even name how many young people in London. So it's really far removed from their community, their specific area. So the more specific you can make it, and that's about locality, community, any of the kind of protected characteristics, more relevant to the lived experience, then that engagement, I think, is there and will carry you through the project. I think the second thing is, you know, especially when you're looking at young people with autism or disabilities, or when we've worked with migrant communities before, it's really leaning on those organisations and partnering those organisations who work with those communities on a day-to-day basis. You know, we are a youth charity, we work with young people, but we are not experts in every single policy field, whether it's housing, mental health. So it's kind of owning up about what the role you play as an organisation is, that youth participation side, and then working with organisations, being flexible about your approach to co-design it with them to kind of meet the needs of those young people. I think the third thing is, and we've talked about this before, that young people aren't taught research, and that is a shame, and research should be in the national curriculum and every young person should be taught research. But actually, it gives me a strange advantage when I'm facilitating these things, because young people aren't asked questions around identity, around poverty. They aren't taught about how policies are made or decisions are made about their lives. So if you're coming in and talking about stuff like biases and loss aversion and, you know, how do you do an in-depth interview? How did the minimum wage get established? When did it get established? What research contributed to it to make politicians make those changes? Suddenly you're making it more relevant to their lives. And suddenly you're talking about an aspect that's very important about decision-making that impacts on their lives. So we've got a bit of an advantage there because they're not taught about it. It's quite novel. And I think that last point is, again, teaching them how research isn't just research, how it leads to impact and change. You know, when we were doing peer evaluation, we'd be teaching about evaluation frameworks. So we'd teach them about Ofsted. What is the evaluation framework that Ofsted uses, and how does that impact on your lives? You might know a young person who was excluded in your school. What were the series of events that led up to that, and how did it come about because of the evaluation framework, which are very important things in how we govern the decisions and policies made by young people. So linking it back to that and linking it back to what is the change that they're going to make and how does research serve as a tool for that? I think everyone is interested in that. You know, if you're just interested in the research part of it, you know, maybe you're there for the research side of it, but everyone's interested in making a difference in their community.
Yeah, and that, so yeah, which circles back quite nicely to the impact stuff we talked about at the beginning, didn't it? Yes, Benita.
I think schools should be very involved in encouraging children to come and join YPAD groups because they're building the foundation and they never know, they're building women, men in STEM, and it's just so good. It's like, I don't know how to explain it, but it's just building a future for the future.
Yeah, so I think convincing schools and youth clubs, and I think one of the things that I've certainly found in terms of involving young people who are kind of less often heard or less likely to get involved in research is the biggest thing for me has been the kind of collaborating with organisations who have established relationships of trust with young people. That's really key. I think when I've done work with, you know, young people who are using drug and alcohol services, young people who've had adverse childhood experiences, or, you know, so many different projects, the difference has been kind of finding a partner who knows those young people and can encourage them to be involved and support them to be involved, and also provide them with support afterwards, because if you're involving them because of difficult lived experiences, it's having somebody who knows them, who can support them if things come up. So I think the collaboration is really important as well. But we have just one more question, because I know we're kind of coming up for time, so one more question for you before we kind of do the wrapping up. So Benita,
how would you like children and young people's involvement in research to develop in the future?
And obviously that's a pretty massive question to end on. But, you know, in an ideal world, where would you like us to go in terms of this work? Who wants to go first? Yes, Begonia.
I can be the first one if I can dream. I think that it would be, for me, a wish for the future to incorporate this as part of the process of any research project, because still it's a very fragmented practice in terms of probably percentages is 1 or 2% of all the clinical research that includes the patient perspective or the parent's perspective. And I think that it's the best way to do research. And we need you, we need the patients and the young people to help us. And I always compare with the process to go to the ethics committee. It's mandatory and nobody discusses about the benefits to have an ethics assessment of your project. Why not incorporate as part of the process the patient involvement? This is my wish, dreaming and thinking in the future.
So I think the ideal future for children and young people's participation in research for me is where it isn't separate and we aren't discussing it as a separate process. At the moment, peer research is very dependent on a borough or a regional government body or a funder being particularly kind of amenable to the idea. They're trying it out. It's still a novel thing. And actually, we want to get to a point where it is firstly respected. There is an evidence base that peer research is best practice in terms of making better decisions, making better policy. But also, it just is a thing that's embedded in all decision making and we don't even think about it as a thing. It's just the good practice. It's the go-to. You know, if we make decisions about young people, it is their right to have a say. And having a say is not simply kind of a tokenistic, really unknowable one thing about we, you know, co-produce this with young people, we consulted young people. There is a clear process, like anything else, about how you consult with young people, you get them involved in meaningful ways in that research process.
I wanted to say something a bit earlier, so I'm going to throw it in now, which is about how you work with young people who don't often get included in YPAGs. And I think it relates because that's one of the things that I would really like to see in the future. I'd like to see research directed and led by children in all sorts of different situations. And many of the young people that I work with are Roma young people or disabled young people or people who just aren't in those spaces. Maybe they don't even like school. So anything that seems too much like school is not going to be right. And what I've learned from them is that if, as you said, Luca May, if you work through people who they trust already, and then you change what research is so that you learn from them how to do research, then it becomes a process they can become involved in. So it kind of relates to what you were saying, Jacob, about people not wanting to sort of listen, maybe not being able to concentrate. So young people that I'm working with in Spain, they have done boxing as a way, as their method for doing research. Because by doing boxing or by doing dancing, you're kind of expressing some things that you feel, and you're experiencing things related to health. And then you can talk about that afterwards, and say some of the really big important things about what needs to change in your community. So one thing I'd like to see change is who's done it. I think the thing is the method. But a third thing is who is making the decisions about where the money goes. And I would like to see children on the panels who make decisions about funding so that children decide what research gets funded.
That's an excellent point. I think it's, and also funding to do that. I think it becomes, this is a bit of, one of the things that I found is I've been writing more and more bids, which are kind of about co-production or young people led research. And the catch 22 is always how you pay the young people for their time in developing the application to do the project, because I think that's always a difficult thing. So yeah, I think that that's really helpful. Thank you, Kath. Lucy, is there anything you wanted to say about how you'd like to see involvement develop in the future?
I've probably said most of kind of what I want to say, but I think there's a danger that as this becomes more accepted and needed for research to be funded and conducted, which of course is amazing, in that you have people that are not authentically trying to do it suddenly writing about co-produced things when they were not co-produced. I think there's a real tendency to jump on language for people to think that the only way anything is going to be funded or done is if they say it's co-designed, co-produced, but it's not actually ever been that, and that's not the way that that participation is happening. So I think that's a danger for the future. I think people need to be really authentic about actually what they are doing and not calling it something because they think it sounds good or what they have to be doing. And my wish for the future, well, I'm going to completely pinch cats, because I think actually the places where children and young people should be being heard are exactly the places that they're not as much as they should be. So yeah,
I think that's a really important point, actually. They get to think about kind of, you know, all of these factors when we're planning what we're going to do and how we're going to involve people. Because I think, you know, it's, you know, you were talking about that as well in terms of, like, you know, the peer research, and there's a real danger that it's suddenly becoming quite fashionable and people don't always understand. It goes back to the thing we were talking about at the beginning about what it needs to do this stuff well in terms of the time, the resourcing, the expertise. And the danger with it becoming a bit of a kind of, you know, flavour of the month is it all either falls out of fashion or you get some really bad, you know, young people's involvement, peer research, co-production that isn't really, and that kind of undermines the work that, you know, the rest of us are doing. So that, yeah, there's a thing about quality, which I think is really important. But yes, Jenny.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that. You know, especially what Kath said in terms of reaching out to diverse groups and community centres and so on. And it does take you as a researcher out of your comfort zone, which is great. It keeps us on our toes. But I've seen so much value in going into centres that young people, you know, go to on a daily basis. It's been amazing. And you really truly hear what's impacting on their lives. But I think another point that we mentioned during the conversation is about, there's an expectation from funders that we should report back to them about what PPI activities have taken place and who was involved and how. And there's checklists out there that we should be following to explain that. And, you know, following a recent review that I've just undertaken with funding reports, it's really quite poor in how people do report PPI activities. So there'll never be any way to learn from that experience. So it's who's accountable for whoever writes those reports, who are they accountable to, and how is that going to be governed, and how is that feedback back to researchers who don't report well to say, you need to do this well, you need to do this better, you need to follow these checklists. So who's doing that? And then how can we learn from that practice? How can we instead of me doing a review or our researchers doing reviews of that information, how can we learn those tangible, simple outputs from that practice in a way that people want to read? They want to read how-to guides, how to do this with different populations, but also they want to connect within the system on the likes of what Kath's doing, what Lucy's doing, what Matthew's doing, what Begonia's doing. We want to connect, see what works, what doesn't work. But how can we do that in a way that's so people don't have to do these massive reviews all the time to find out what's going on in the system?
I think it's really interesting. So there's a few kind of big themes that are coming out for me. One of them is kind of how we evaluate, how we demonstrate what works. But there's also that thing about the before and after of the research, what we think of as the research process. So the kind of before in terms of commissioning, but also priority setting. So who decides what research is prioritized, what research gets commissioned, who decides how it's funded, you know, all of those things, and how young people could be involved in that. And then also at the other end, you've talked about that in terms of, you know, disseminating the learning, putting it into practice. So no, I think that's really helpful. Thank you. But I'm aware that we're out of time now. So we could have carried on with this for another hour or two, I think. So we'll maybe have to do another podcast or two in the future. But we just have two quick questions to wrap up.
Is your tippity top tip for researchers who want to involve children and young people? Just one each, please. We'll start with Begonia.
So what's your one top tip for researchers who want to involve children and young people?
Top tips. One, approach the patient's community as soon as possible.
Yep. Okay, great.
Okay. Lucy.
I guess for me, it's being open to things not going as you'd planned. So knowing that you're going to have to be quite flexible, not going in thinking that it's such and such is going to happen, but remaining open to learn from the children, young people as to how they want to do things.
Kath.
Realise that children will know more about almost everything than you do.
Matthew.
Involve them in as much as possible, from the font size in the report to the colours to the serious things around ethics and consent.
And last but not least, Jenny.
Speak to those with the skills and know-how to do this meaningfully with children, young people.
And you complete the sentence, I think children and young people should be involved in research because... can we start with Jenny?
Because you'd be a fool not to.
Lucy, please.
I think that children and people should be involved in research because it helps make sure that the research that we're doing addresses what matters to children and young people. But most importantly, it's always much more fun to work with children and young people than it is with adults generally.
It's nice to hear that. Matt, please.
I think children and young people should be involved in research because it is their right to have a say in decisions that are made about them.
Thank you. And Cass?
I think children and young people should be involved in research because the more they're involved, the better the research is and the more difference that can make for the lives of other children, young people and adults in the rest of the world.
Oh, and Begonia, I did not forget you.
Certainly.
Don't worry. It's so difficult to be the last because I agree with everything that my colleague said. And I think that it's a matter to realize that from the beginning to the end, research needs to be, you know, focused in the needs and, you know, what matters to the patients.
Thank you.
Sadly, that's all we have time for today. But thank you so much to our guests, Begonia, Kath, Jenny, Lucy, and Matthew, for all your amazing insights and ideas.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please let people know about it and also keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @HertYPAG or email us at ypag@hert.ac.uk. We'd love to carry on the conversation.